Local Talk is the signature local interview program on KHOI that explores people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. It celebrates the creativity, diversity, and civic spirit of our community. This interview aired on Local Talk.
Among our autumn traditions in the U.S. are two holidays, Thanksgiving and Columbus Day, both of which are associated with certain stories or narratives about discovery, colonization, and Native Americans. A few weeks ago, I interviewed a first-grade teacher in Ames about how she engages her students in learning about Native Americans. And today, we have an interview with Sebastian Braun, the director of the American Indian Studies Program at ISU. The reason I invited you in to speak with us, particularly at this time of year, is because it's Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. Right. And so I wanted to have a conversation with you about the way those holidays portray Native Americans and what's problematic about that.
Sure. I mean, so as you said, I'm not going to speak what they mean for Americans, Native peoples. But the way they're portrayed, and I think the narrative that they tell is really something that should be discussed, yeah. Maybe if you could start with Thanksgiving, that's an easier one, I think, at least for me to discuss.
Okay.
I mean, Thanksgiving as a holiday, right, celebrates this first, basically the narrative is that it celebrates this first encounter between the pilgrims and the native people. And what I always tell my students is that if they remember Thanksgiving, it's the native people who give food to the pilgrims and introduce them to agriculture. In the New World, at least, or in the so-called New World for the Europeans, and who share with them and are open and welcoming. And it's that maybe we should celebrate. And most often, however, that narrative is sometimes turned around in terms of Europeans come here to help native people and to bring them civilization and to make them understand how things really work. And while that is a very frequent narrative, it is one that goes absolutely to the opposite of what actually happened.
And is there evidence that the kind of coming together of the pilgrims and Native Americans, there is evidence that there actually was that kind of coming together where the Native Americans actually did assist the settlers in learning how to do agriculture here in this climate and continent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if that, you know, encounter didn't happen as it is portrayed, mm-hmm. right? All we have to do is look at Iowa. I mean, what do we plant in Iowa? Corn. Well, where does corn come from? Well, it was domesticated by Native peoples in Mexico and then was long planted in Iowa before the first Europeans showed up. And so, yeah, that's all the evidence I think we need here in Iowa to see how these encounters did happen.
But the more common narrative is that the Native Americans knew very little, and it was the Europeans who were bringing knowledge and a different way of life to them in a savior kind of way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, they absolutely brought a different way of life, of course, right? But they also, I mean, they impose that on native peoples. And I think that is, of course, part of the problem. And I think the narratives that exist, as you said, that, you know, the Europeans helped native peoples is kind of the legitimization for imposing this different way of life upon them, right? What right does somebody have to impose their own culture, their own way of life on somebody else, to change their societies to live on their land, to prohibit them from living their culture? Well, the most popular legitimization for that is, but we are helping you to see the light by doing this, right? We are helping you to survive. We are helping you to be successful. We want to improve your life. Live like us and you will be better off, mm-hmm. right? And so that is exactly that narrative.
So inherent in that is the assumption that the Indian way of life, their culture, was deficient.
Exactly.
In many ways.
Yeah.
All ways, really.
In all ways, yeah. I mean, if you read Columbus, to come to Columbus,
okay.
right? Columbus, you know, establishes that very well. In his journals, he constantly talks of native peoples that he encounters in the Caribbean as having no clothes and having no religion, not even another religion, but because it is different from Christianity, no religion, having no language because it is so different that he doesn't understand it, so it cannot be a language, right? Having no laws, because they're different from his laws and he doesn't understand them. So there can't be any real laws. So they have no laws and having no property because the property, the way that property is handled is so different that he doesn't understand it. And so it cannot be real property. So you have this ethnocentric worldview, right? This worldview that my cultural standards are the only ones that matter and therefore I can measure everybody else by my own cultural standards. And the judgment by Europeans, and Columbus is just the first one who does that, right? The judgment by Europeans is always, they don't do what we do. They don't do the right religion, so they have no religion. They don't speak the right language, so they have no language. And that's kind of the beginning of this assessment. They have no civilization. They have no culture. They lack in anything.
And we know this from Columbus's own writings and the writings of other people who were in his ships.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In Columbus's own journals, the way that he describes native people is like that, yeah.
And yet we have a very different portrayal of Columbus in the narrative that goes along with Columbus is very different than that.
Right. So I'm not from the United States and Columbus Day doesn't register, you know, because I didn't grow up with it. So I'm always surprised that my kids don't have to go to school, for example, right? I think part of what makes this amazement so great for me is that Columbus didn't discover, if he discovered anything, but never set foot in the United States. And so the celebration of Columbus Day in the United States is something that needs, I think, a lot of explanation. The fact that Columbus is so sometimes revered as like kind of almost the father of a nation or something like that, like is historically absolutely incorrect.
Because he basically landed on islands in the Caribbean, Cuba,
right,
and what was called Hispaniola.
Several of those smaller islands,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so when he did land on those islands, he encountered the native people there who are called the Taino, is that correctly?
Some of them, yeah.
Pronounced?
Yes.
And so what is known about them?
So the Taino are the ones that we know most about. We don't know much about other native peoples in the Caribbean, and we don't know too much about the Taino because within about 50 to 75 years, most of these people were dead. And I mean, they were basically extinct as people. There were no survivors of these people, in part because of the direct treatment from the Spanish, and in part because they were used as slaves on the plantations that the Spanish started to build, and many of them committed suicide. Many of them tried to run away, but had no longer any way to support themselves because their settlements were gone or controlled by the Spanish, and quite a few of them were directly killed by the Spanish. When we look at the Caribbean, we have archaeological evidence for native peoples there. We have what the Spanish wrote in their journals about them, but that's in almost every case, that's it.
And do we know what happened when Columbus and his men actually encountered the Taino?
Yeah, we pretty much know that. Yeah, because you know, the Spanish thought they were doing the right thing, so they had no reason to not describe what they were doing. And so Columbus was looking for gold. Columbus was a very medieval person, if you want. So he knew that there was gold in the Caribbean because there were parrots. And Columbus was convinced that there was a causal relationship between parrots and gold, because he knew that from West Africa. And in West Africa, there are parrots and there is gold. And so he put the two together. And so he was looking for gold. He was convinced that he was in China or somewhere around there. And so he actually did not really discover a new world. He was, his whole life, even after the fourth voyage, he was absolutely convinced that he was, but in somewhere in East Asia. And so just as he was convinced of that, he was convinced there was gold. And so if the native people didn't tell him where the gold was, because there was no gold, it couldn't be that there was no gold. There had to be gold, and they wouldn't tell him. And so he tortured them until they would tell him. And he's very clear about that. The Spanish had dogs, which proved to be, for them, a great way of controlling native people. They set them free, and they were trained attack dogs. They ripped native people to pieces. There is one story that one of the Spanish officers wanted to see if his sword was sharpened enough, and he tried that out by by cutting down native people, basically. And you can see kind of see what the value of native people was for, well, for the Spanish. In effect, because they had no, right, because they thought they had no religion, no law, no culture, they were not human, mm-hmm. right? And so they were treated as animals.
So they were just considered expendable or worthless unless they could provide information
exactly.
on where gold was.
Yeah.
That is so different than the way Columbus is often portrayed.
Yes.
And from a education viewpoint, you mentioned that children will have off in many locations, off from school, a holiday. But leading up to Columbus, I remember when I was in school, there were all kinds of traditions associated with both Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, whether it was dressing up as pilgrims and Native Americans or coloring in pictures of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. So do you have any sense if a lot of that has been changed or does some of that still exist?
I think there are a lot of teachers who are really trying to do things differently today. And I, from what I hear, there's still some of the pilgrims and Indians and, you know, things like that. And I think some of these things still persist, not because teachers think those are great activities to do with their children, but because teachers do not have an alternative that they would know, you know, how to bring these stories to life in a different way. And I think that's really a huge obstacle that exists, is that we have not produced the materials that would give teachers who want to do something else a guidance on what they could do, on what they maybe should do. And I think that's why oftentimes even teachers who want to change things, they don't know how to do it.
So the need for resources and preparation for the teachers to know how to broach these subjects and
yeah.
other kinds of activities, especially
yeah.
with different ages of students, because obviously it would have to differ with first graders versus high school students.
Right, exactly. And right now, I mean, if Thanksgiving is simply pilgrims and Indians meeting and you want to do something with Thanksgiving, then K through 12, you play pilgrims and Indians, right? Well, if you would, for example, look at the consequences of that encounter, you know, you could maybe have a range of things in increasing complexity and talk about those narratives with increasing complexity, looking at what comes out of this encounter, looking at, you know, treaties, looking at the present situation and kind of like, you know, scaffold that through the grades. But how many teachers, you know, how many teachers take Native history classes?
Mm-hmm.
How many teachers take African-American history classes, right? There is this dominant historical narrative, and it is there for a reason, right? It's the origin story of the United States as a country. And how much more content can we stuff into teacher education? I mean, those are all important questions, too.
A growing number of cities and states, and I was surprised to learn that this is now true of Iowa. Other jurisdictions
yes.
had done that, some states,
yeah. Yeah.
a few states, and a number of cities and towns had changed the name to Indigenous Peoples Day. What are your thoughts on that?
So on one hand, I think it's great that we have Indigenous Peoples Day. On the other hand, if it's just Indigenous Peoples Day and you know, there's one day in a year that we kind of remember in some ways that there are Indigenous peoples around, that doesn't change too much. It's nice to, it's, you know, again, I don't want to minimize that,
mm-hmm.
but it's a symbol, right? It's
mm-hmm.
a symbol, perhaps, of change. The interesting thing about this change is that the real reason why people celebrate Columbus Day in the United States is because Italian Americans were discriminated against in the early 20th century, and they needed kind of like a positive role model to show other Americans that they were not uncivilized and they should be treated in equality with other peoples. And so they said, well, who better than Columbus? And so he was appropriated for this purpose, right? So you have this holiday that was originating in this effort to erase discrimination that has now become a symbol of discrimination. And we're replacing it with a holiday that fulfills that role now for a different group of people. In some ways, I wish not that we would continue to celebrate Columbus Day, at least not in the form that it's mm-hmm. being done, but that we would not now construct this conflict between groups of people again, because we're replacing one by the other. And I think a lot of the backlashes that come out against Indigenous people sometimes are rooted exactly in that. It's in the fear that if we now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day and we take away Columbus Day, it's seen as a sign that somehow people are going to take away people's rights and replacing mm-hmm. them with other people's rights. And it's a zero-sum game, and it doesn't lead anywhere. So I'm all for Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm critical, hesitant about Columbus Day, at least the way it has been celebrated. But I wish we could simply remember the actual history of what happened both to Italian Americans in this country and how they became integrated, or why, or what they had to give up to become integrated into this society, how much struggle that was. And we should also remember, of course, what Indigenous peoples had to endure and have to go through in efforts to gain equality in this society.
We often hear about what happened with the Native Americans on the East Coast.
Yes.
And we also hear a lot about some of the big battles and so on, whether, you know, the Little Bighorn and, yeah. you know, those kinds of things. But you don't hear a lot about what happened in the Midwest, in Iowa.
Yes.
And I know that's asking you to give an entire history course, it could be.
Yeah, I think, you know.
I mean, in Iowa.
Yeah. One of the reasons why we don't hear about Iowa, right, is that there are not these famous battles in Iowa. And it's true, right? That is true. What happened in Iowa is more what we might call structural violence that is exerted on Native peoples. Not direct violence, but structural violence, because what happened in Iowa is that Indigenous peoples, Native societies, Native groups, American Indian tribes, were removed from Iowa through a treaty process that was highly unequal. That is, what usually happened in the Midwest is that tribes had become dependent on trade goods. But the fur trade had moved on, right? So as the fur trade moved on and tribes still needed these trade goods, they incurred debts. And treaties then came in, and the United States government basically said, look, we're going to pay off your debts to these traders in exchange for your land. Thomas Jefferson basically planned this out very consciously after Louisiana Purchase. I mean, he basically proposes this policy. And at the time it comes to Iowa is from the 18-teens through the 1840s. And so one of the reasons why Iowa as a state starts to exist in 1846 is that by 1845, most Native peoples had been removed mm-hmm. from Iowa, apart from like northern Iowa, which is still Dakota Territory until 1851. And so it's this process that is often forgotten because people don't want to remember treaties. People don't, you know, but there were no famous battles. There was none of this exciting history, you know, that we often focus on. And instead, what happened is that between 1800 and 1850, right, in those 50 years, what happens in Iowa is that you go from absolutely sovereign Native nations who are independent, who have their own cultures, their own societies, their own laws, make their own decisions about their future, you go to an absolute absence of Native peoples in Iowa until a few years later then the Meskwaki are able to purchase lands in Iowa and come back and establish the Meskwaki settlement. I mean, so if somebody was 10 years old in 1800, right, and was imbued in this vibrant culture and in this vibrant societies, by the time that they were an old person, they were living in exile on small reservations, no longer in their homeland, in a different environment. Their societies had to adapt to these different environments, to smaller lands. They were absolutely dependent on the American government and therefore had to do whatever the federal government told them to do. If you think about that in this kind of personal yeah. narrative, it makes it clear how much upheaval happened at that time and how much, you know, again, not direct violence necessarily, but how much structural violence was exerted on these societies.
Yeah. And if people are interested in learning more about a more realistic understanding of what happened to Native Americans here in Iowa, are there any books or films?
There are books. There's a really good book by Lance Foster, who's the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, which is Indians of Iowa. It's just called Indians of Iowa. And it gives an overview, at least, of kind of like a very basic overview, but really a great overview of kind of like who was here, what Native peoples were here, and sort of how they lived. That's a great place to start for anybody. there. Okay. And if anybody wants to know which resources are there, you feel free to contact me.
And you mentioned that you're not from the U.S.
Yes.
Then how did you become interested in Native Americans?
So I'm from Europe. And when I talk to many people here, also Native peoples, and as, you know, we talk about what we did as children, right? And oftentimes people say, well, we played Indians and cowboys. And many Native peoples have told me, well, we always wanted to be the cowboys because we were told that, that it wasn't good to be Indian, right? And it was the opposite in where I grew up. We also played Indians and cowboys. But we always wanted to be the Indians because we knew that the cowboys were the bad guys. I'm saying this because I think there is this narrative in Europe where the roles are reversed, where there's a critical view, a much more critical view of the American government. What people know is that the Indians were not treated right. And it's so interesting to me that there's this difference, right? I didn't start out wanting to focus on Native America. I was focusing on Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, and that's what I was going to do as an anthropologist. Then it was 1992, and so 1992, we had this seminar at the university, 500 years of oppression, right? And again, there's this different narrative, right? And I kind of became more interested in Native North American.
Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure.
And thank you for filling us in and giving us a lot to think about in terms of what's a more realistic understanding of the Native American experience, especially as these holidays roll around.
Thank you for having me.
You can hear more interviews like this on Local Talk Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on 89.1 KHOI Community Radio. You can support Community Radio through the donate button at khoifm.org.